Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. So, in the autumn statement, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt made the announcement he'd be cutting national insurance for employed people by 2 percentage points to 10%. Fast forward to the budget we had just a few weeks ago, where we saw Hunt put employee NI on the chopping block once again, cutting it to 8%, which is due to come into effect in April. Now, rumours are brewing that the Conservatives might decide to ditch the tax altogether ahead of the general election. But in reality, what could the abolishment of employee national insurance really look like, and what could the impacts of it be? I'm Alina Khan, senior reporter for FT Advisor, and I'm joined today by Tom Selby, director of public policy at AJ Bell, Ian Cook, chartered financial planner at Quilter Cheviot, and Susan Hope, IFA workplace senior manager at Scottish Widows. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
Morning.
So, before we look forward, I want us to cast our mind back to the budget, which obviously feels like a lifetime ago now, for me anyway. Why do you think Hunt decided to cut employee NI further following his autumn statement? And is it really going to have an impact on people's lives? Because I know people have said that actually due to frozen thresholds and things, it might not actually have as big of an impact as maybe he would have liked it to. I'll start with you, Tom.
There's a general election coming. There isn't a huge amount of money. And I think the government and Rishi Sunak were looking for a potential vote winner that would go into people's pockets now, that wouldn't cost as much as cutting income tax. I think there's also an attempt to reward work. So clearly everyone knows that the economy's been struggling, that productivity has been pretty flat for the best part of 20 years. And so targeting that pre-election move at people who are in work, I think was, you know, probably as far as Jeremy Hunt was able to go. I'm sure he would have liked to go further. I'm sure he'd have liked to give more away to encourage people to vote Conservative whenever we get that general election. But I think it was viewed as being the cleanest, biggest thing that the government could do to reward work, to put more money in people's pockets ahead of a general election, obviously after the 2p cut in NI that we saw in January.
Ian?
It felt like a fairly safe cut from the Chancellor because he's firing, I guess, the first bullet or the salvo for the general election that's going to be coming. Is there something else that's going to come further down the road? Had he cut income tax, I think there's a far wider range of people it would have hit or it would have benefited, such as pensioners, but it would have cost the Chancellor so much more money. So it was a fairly easy win. Very short term, I think, because notwithstanding whoever the next Chancellor is, if it's Jeremy Hunt, they could increase the contribution level straight back up. So very lukewarm. It certainly hasn't been taken particularly well across my client bank that I deal with. They've not been overly enamoured with it. They felt especially they could have done some more, but let's wait and see what happens.
And Susan, what about you?
I mean, yeah, all of these comments absolutely resonate. I feel like we've been in a little bit of a hokey-cokey with NI, having been so close to salary exchange and talking about it on a daily basis. We've been up as high as 13.25% and we've been down as low as 8%. And could we now go lower? So, yeah, resonate with everything everyone else has said, but I don't think this is the last that we'll see.
Yeah, I think one of the frustrating things, I guess, about tax policy generally when you get it, when you described it there as the hokey cokey. I'm sure for you guys, for clients, it's not ideal that you seem to have this constantly moving feast. I mean, I know we've on a different subject, we won't get into that today, I'm sure, but on the subject of ISAs and the direction of travel from this government, we've had a real problem with them at one point saying we want ISA simplification and then at the next point saying we want to introduce a new type of ISA. And similarly, it feels to me like with tax policy in particular, I'd be interested to know from your point of view, from a client's perspective, but it feels like constantly kind of chipping away, even if it's in a positive way, it adds to this sense that everything's kind of moving from under you and there's not really any certainty there to plan around.
It tinkers around the edge.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's on most consumer clients' minds generally is the fiscal drag. I think policy's been such that the levels have been held for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's really upsetting people. You know, typical working class people being dragged into higher rate tax, paying higher rates of tax, because generally the perception with national insurance, certainly that I've seen from clients, is it's a tax that they pay, but they don't pay a lot of attention to it. Back in the days of 12% national insurance, you're paying an effective rate of 32% versus a high rate tax paying 42%, but it just doesn't feel like that. So the fiscal drag in the tax policies, the thing that most people are talking about, and I think it becomes slightly irksome. You're right, Tom.
Yeah.
I mean, if we even get onto the £100,000 tax trap, most people, again, are unaware of it. They're sliding through that bracket. Higher earners get a little bit of a bonus on top, not really aware that their effective rate is 60%. So it's difficult, hence why the likes of salary exchange, salary sacrifice is a really useful tool. But, yeah, not really too sure where we would go from here.
And Susan, having, you know, in your job, you do speak to a lot of advisors, sort of.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
So salary exchange for me is the pensions fairy tale. It's the fairy tale of the pensions industry because everyone involved lives happily ever after. So if you think about it, the employee lives happily ever after because they either get more money in their take home pay or they get more into their pension. The employer has a cost saving, or he can redirect that cost saving to, you know, attract and retain staff and build extra benefits in. And the advisor has a real role to play here. I referred to earlier as the hokey cokey. We've seen employer NI change from 15.05 down to 13.8. We've seen employee NI change. We've seen the national living wage change considerably. All of these are really important points of advice that advisors can give to their corporate clients. So to me, even with a reduction in employee NI, there is still a compelling story for salary exchange. And that's to take the point that Tom and Ian were talking about, that higher rate tax point. There's a real misunderstanding from people on higher rate tax relief, with lots of people not claiming it. I won't dwell on it too much, but there was a Mori poll done years ago which talked about understanding of tax relief. And higher rate taxpayers thought that the level of tax relief that they got was 14.5%. So salary exchange, more than just the NI saving, gives people that correct rate of relief at outset, and that's absolutely key, whether or not employee NI goes.
Susan, I think that's one of the critical points. Again, dealing more with a consumer and client end, the ability for a client to make a pension contribution, forget about it, not need to necessarily do a tax return. That simplification, even with the eradication, if we get to that point of national insurance disappearing, for me, there's still a huge need for salary exchange. Salary sacrifice is such a useful tool because most people do not like logging in to do their tax returns. So it's a very, very useful benefit and a tool.
But obviously, if NI is to be cut, as the rumours are sort of circulating, that's obviously going to make salary sacrifice not very attractive anymore, right? And because of that, what is that going to mean for it, really?
I don't think it makes it less attractive because of the simplification from the contribution perspective that we've just mentioned. So it's still a really useful tool. When I'm with my clients that are employed, if they have an option to salary sacrifice or make a personal contribution, I would always ask them to do it from their salary directly, because again, it means that they do not need to do that reclaim from HMRC. So I feel there would be a need beyond national insurance abolishment.
It would be less attractive, as in from in pounds and pence terms, right? If I think that's the point you're making, right, Alina? If national insurance goes down, then the amount that you save by doing it goes down. So I think it kind of self-evidently will become slightly less financially attractive. But I think Ian's point's absolutely the right one. You've still got employer NI. I'm sure lots of employers would be even more forthright about sharing their savings with employees if we did get to this world of abolishing national insurance, which I think, by the way, we are quite a long way away from at the moment. But if we did get to that point, then I'm sure employers would do that. From a personal perspective, my pension contributions are through salary sacrifice. I'm in the industry, and I still find it pleasing that it goes straight off my salary. I know exactly the tax relief I'm getting. It's completely hands off. I don't need to do anything about it. So if we were to get to a world where salary sacrifice, where national insurance, was removed, yes, it would be less attractive financially. But I think lots of people would still choose to do it.
I agree. I still see clients that have got net pay arrangements, which I find absolutely crazy. And I guess from Susan's perspective, you'd expect perhaps to see more employers engaging with salary sacrifice if NI was to do it here.
I mean, absolutely. So for the first thing is, I sometimes feel like I'm on a one-woman crusade to change the language. So when we do salary exchange research with our advisors, the kind of four main things that come up are, it's complex to communicate and implement, there's a lack of employer understanding, and there's an employee concern over the perceived sacrifice. So I think we need to start to think about this as salary exchange. This truly is an exchange of gross salary for employer contribution. So to me, I think changing the language and also making sure that the employer is aware of the 13.8% benefit that he has when times are really difficult at the moment, I think that will really help with the perception of salary exchange. And let's keep the longevity of it as that pension fairy tale.
But would, Susan, what would your views be on if we got to this utopia of employee NI disappearing? Do you think salary exchange would be at risk? Because Chancellor's got to get the money back somehow.
I don't think it would. And the reason I don't think it would is because the 13.8% employer NI stays. So if you think about employers, usually the second biggest expense the employer has is the pension. So the employer has to make sure they're squeezing every single pound of benefit they can for these employee benefits. And salary exchange is the best way to do that, you know. So I don't think, as long as employer NI is here, we may see the shape of the salary exchange implementation change. So at the moment, if employers are favouring keeping the 13.8%, that may change because the narrative will be more difficult to sell to employees. But I do think it will stay for as long as employer NI stays.
And if it were to be cut, you know, like you say, Tom, we're probably a long way off it and it may never happen. Mm. These are just rumours. But, you know, the Conservatives are known to like to pull rabbits out of a hat when it comes to big announcements. So we'll have to wait and see. But if it is to be cut, what effect is this going to have on people? Because it will have an effect, I assume, on people's savings, you know, in their pensions, and will surely have a knock-on effect on people in their retirement, right? Because at the minute, you know, we know that people aren't saving enough for their retirement, and that is a problem that we have currently in this country. What could that have? Would it even have an impact?
So I guess the first impact would be that if it was just national insurance was abolished and everything else stays the same, then your take-home pay goes up, so you've got a bit more money to spend, and then you can choose whether you want to save that or spend it like with any other money or savings that you have. I guess, but overall, and I guess this has been more, I guess, one of my bugbears with the kind of debate around national insurance and particularly around the state pension. There isn't, as far as I can see, a direct link between national insurance and the state pension, or national insurance and actually retirement or anyone's ability to save. National insurance is essentially another form of tax on your income. Now, it's only applied to earned income and not onto retirement income. But I think the way, and it obviously was something that was created post World War II, but having this separation between national insurance and this kind of myth that perpetuates that somehow national insurance sits in a separate place. I mean, I say a myth, it does sit in a national insurance fund, but that doesn't matter from the Treasury's perspective. It doesn't matter from the government's perspective. If that national insurance fund runs out and it is projected to over the next 20 years or so, then the government will just take the money from the general tax pot. So cutting national insurance doesn't, in and of itself, I don't think, affect people's private pensions or people's state pension entitlement. There'll be a question about how you build up state pension entitlement, because that's currently based on personal national insurance contributions. But I'm sure if we were to have a government that removed national insurance, they'd be able to put in a different system. But in terms of your state pension, if the government were to cut income tax, then that would potentially put people's, you know, the value of the state pension at risk, only in that there's less tax coming in and a government would have to choose whether to spend money on the state pension, whether to spend it on, you know, defence, benefits, all the other stuff. But that link between NI and state benefits and NHS payments, all the rest of it, in my view, is always used in quite a misleading way, and it doesn't really work like that.
Yeah, I think definitely, like you say, seeing people in the media and things, they do make that link. And with sort of NI having been cut, a lot of people are questioning that funding link between the state pension and NI. So that's quite...
That delinking really started with the new state pension, single-tier state pension a number of years ago. So I think public perception is beginning to change. You're often seeing a lot of policy or people talking about policy change in relation to state pension. So is there something brewing? If national insurance was removed, would it be reinstated with a mandatory state pension contribution? Would we go back to a SERP-style system? Who knows? This is what I mean. I think it raises more questions. You make a good point, Tom. It's the state pension, NI contributions are linked to the 35 years you need to qualify for state pension. So that mechanism would need to be replaced. There's so much to answer for if that was to ever happen. I think we'd be rewriting quite a lot of the tax policy. And I think realistically, coming back to Tom's original point, it's the first part of the Conservatives really looking toward their manifesto and really clutching at straws, rabbits out of hats, call it what you like. So,
yeah, well, it's interesting because I think it's natural that we're talking about this as in the kind of quite narrow, would national insurance just go and everything else stay the same? The debate that's been going on for a long time, actually, is the idea of merging national insurance and income tax and potentially, you know, it doing that in a tax neutral way almost. So then you could raise the level of income tax. Now, whether any politician's going to be brave enough to do that when you're talking about the incomes of retirees, the people who are most likely to vote at a general election, one of the largest sections of the population, I don't know. But certainly in my time historically, the debate's been, and I think there's a really sensible debate to be had about moving to a single rate of tax on your incomes, because it is kind of an odd thing that you've got national insurance and income tax, and actually they're both going into the same pot and doing the same thing. And if you could move to a world where it was simpler and there's one tax on incomes, then I think that would be a good thing. But it would require a government, I think, that was kind of brave enough to say to people that actually in merging these, income tax is going to go up. The impact on most people's, over the piece, the impact on your people's take-home pay will be neutral and it will be done in a fair way. But some people will end up paying more tax as a result of that, and some people won't. I don't know if we'll get there or not. I suspect this is, as Ian was saying, is just a kind of a pre-election kite flying type thing that allows the government to say it's got this long term ambition when the economy allows, and I expect that point in time will never come.
Completely agree. A simplification of the tax system, I think, is warranted. It's merited. Again, finger in the air. What might someone do to appease the grey vote? Would they take the state pension out of the taxation system, and then realistically, again, the more wealthy would be the ones that were taxed from the investments, private pensions that they've built up, and other such places. So I think there's a lot of levers to be pulled, but whether we're in that place, even for the prospective government that's coming, I'm just not too sure. I think we've got bigger problems.
I think as well, there's also the added point that at the other end, we were about to have automatic enrolment extension, auto enrolment 2.0, where 18-year-olds are now going to be auto enrolled in. So there's going to be savings earlier. Employers are going to have to make that cost. So they've got an additional cost now in their workplace savings scheme for those people entering earlier, 4 years earlier. And then there's also the issue of qualifying earnings schemes, that lower earnings limit going. So there's another £187 per employee these employers need to find for qualifying earnings schemes. So salary exchange really has a role to play here in trying to mitigate that cost, and advisors have a role to play in advising on that. So, yeah, I do wonder about that. We've got 18-year-olds being... Oh, sorry, go on. I just think 18-year-olds are now going to be auto-enrolled in and going to be working for 50 years until they get their state pension, potentially.
Susan, you mentioned that advisors will have a role to play in that. Can you maybe delve into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I just think about the last 2 years, and I know we've touched on it, but we've had three or four different amounts of employee NI. We've had two different amounts of employer NI. We've had the national living wage going up from 950 to 1144, which means a different salary exchange floor. There are so many moving parts of this. Advisors can address the point that we find that prevents employers from implementing salary exchange. So advisors can help with that clarification at outset, and they can also ensure a thorough review every year as we deal with these continual changes. So to me, salary exchange is a huge opportunity for all advisors, both now and in the future, as we come to deal with automatic enrolment extension when it comes.
And Ian, obviously being a financial planner yourself, can you maybe give me your thoughts on that, being in, you know, sort of firsthand speaking to those, your clients?
So truthfully, it's not really a market I deal with. So I haven't got a huge, impact. And this is one of my passions, because I feel it's an underserved market. Who's out there actually encouraging these people to opt in or stay opted into their auto-enrolled schemes? That's what I would like to see the government really focus on, is really put something, I don't know whether there'll be a cash contribution, but get something behind, get some literature out there, get some marketing out there, educate people in schools what a pension is, what a state pension is. Get the knowledge out there, because I feel that there's a huge knowledge gap. And, you know, I liken it, this was pre-me advising, but I liken it to the days when, you know, the man down the pub would sell a pension to his plumber mate who didn't really know what he was buying, but there was enough in it for the financial advisor. Obviously, we're talking a commission world there. And lo and behold, the guy that hasn't really actively saved has got some money at the end of his life. Well, that market doesn't exist anymore. I mean, we're talking about a different market, an 18 to 25-year-old market, but getting people to save early is generally the biggest challenge I've got. I'm really only seeing clients that have got wealth, they've accumulated wealth, or they're significant earners that are in a position to be able to make significant contributions, because it's not financially viable for me as a financial planner to serve those clients at that end. And that feels tough for me. I come from a military background, and again, I fell into a final salary pension. So I was lucky enough that I got out towards my 30s and then realised, just happened to have this pot, and then into financial services and beyond, really.
A key stat there, though, just that's really, you can't unhear it or unsee it, is the benefits of someone starting 4 years earlier at 18 instead of 22, assuming a £30,000 salary in a normal pension scheme, means a difference of £46,000 to that young person. And that's the type of headline-grabbing stat that we need to be focusing in on with this population. Because I don't know if you saw the De Facto research, they did a panel with Gen Z who basically said, put the information on TikTok and make it 24 seconds and then we'll engage. So that's what we're dealing with. But £46,000 to me is compelling.
Susan, that's a staggering amount of money. It's an staggering amount of money for just fire and forget, coming off your contributions. You know, exactly. I used to be involved in an employee benefits business in the past, a number of years ago, and the amount of people that used to opt out, no matter, as an advisor, I'm sat there explaining the benefits of it. It's the live now culture. I want to have that money in my pocket today. I'm not really concerned about 50 years in the future. And having been a young person once, I can't disagree.
You're still a young Ian. I didn't think we were going to get an opportunity to talk about this on this podcast, but I think it's fantastic that we are, because I agree with everything that Ian said. I agree with everything that Susan said. And I think the biggest opportunity to improve the lives of the most people is through improving the information and the way that information is delivered to them. And ideally that's through financial advice, be that a corporate advisor or with an individual conversation with an advisor, or through better quality guidance given to people. And it's a complete, you'd have to have a whole other podcast to talk about the advice guidance, boundary review and financial education and all the rest of it. But that's a huge passion of mine. I genuinely think there's so much time, I think particularly post-pension freedom, so much time has been spent calling for innovation in products. So I think it's a habit that the industry has of saying, where's the new product to solve everyone's problem? And actually, when I look at the products available, salary sacrifice, you know, SIPs, workplace pensions, ISAs, general investment accounts, all the rest of it, actually, you've got everything there that you need. What we don't have is a population who understand their options and are getting the help they need. And I think if we do really focus in the next kind of 5, 10, 15 years on improving the help, getting more people in front of an advisor and improving the quality of information, help and guidance and the usefulness of that guidance, then I think we really might get somewhere.
I totally agree. It's all about meeting people where they're at. I'm conscious of time. Tell you quickly something very, very funny. My daughter's about to turn 18. She wants a pair of designer shoes. Hopefully the ladies in the audience will understand Christian Louboutin. Is she getting... No, she is not getting those because she's a contribution. She's getting a pension for her 18th birthday because if I start giving my third-party contribution to her, I close her gender pension gap and I help her meet that 46,000. So that's the best thing I can do for her as a parent. She's not going to be happy. Probably won't forgive me for 6 months, but I feel like I've done the right thing.
I'm trying to think what I'd do if my mum had given me a pension contribution on my 18th birthday.
I'm slightly wilting here because I've done the same for my son.
Oh my God, my word. These poor kids. I mean, in the long run, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be in a good position.
But
I mean,
I've got a junior ISA for him as well.
But this is
getting a supercar.
I think this is the issue. I'm going to be turning 23 next month.
Oh,
and
God, I didn't need that.
But, you know, I was, you know, being in this job, my friends ask me, you know, so what's happening? You know, what the budget happened? What happened? I said, oh, you know, NI's been cut again. And they're sort of looking at me like, right, okay, what does that mean? How does that affect me? You know, like, and talking to them about pensions, I say, you know, do you guys all have a pension? I think so. I think I contribute to my workplace, but I'm not sure. You know, I said, have you guys got life ISAs? I've got one. I've opened one up. What about you guys? What is that? What does that do? And I think it kind of ties back to what we're talking about, how, like, if the tax system was to be simplified, it might help people to understand things a bit better. I think pensions as well is such a complex landscape. Even me working in this industry, I still have so much that I sit there sometimes and it blows my mind. But I think it's simplifying things may help for younger people to maybe understand it a bit better. And hopefully, Susan, your daughter, if she were to understand it better, she actually might thank you and say, oh, wow, thanks so much. Because if I had someone at 18 who had told me, you know, I'm going to give you a pension, you know, I'd be quite grateful now knowing what I know. But I just wish other people my age understood that because I don't think they do.
So a personal story for me. Personal story for me. So I joined the military at the age of 16. They did all of my secondary education. I became an engineer and a helicopter pilot. So I had a great career, but I cut that career short, unaware that actually if I'd have stayed a little bit longer, my pension benefits would have been grossly increased. I had no clue what I had. And I think had I been educated, and clearly that's the armed forces position to do that, but had I been educated, I might have made a different decision. And that's me as a financial planner. And I was interested in financial services whilst I was in the military and I had various products at the time. And that's quite startling that, you know, it's really not until people get in toward their late 30s, early 40s when you think, actually, I've got a little bit less work left in me than when I started. The end is closer than the beginning. And that's really when people switch on. But all of the good work could have been done in the earlier years.
Yeah.
Echoing Susan's point.
I think the kids of today, I sound like a real oldie, but, you know, we're in this Amazon one-click buy environment. So you need to give them the dopamine hit. Employee contribution, then employer contribution, free money, ka-ching. Tax relief, free money, ka-ching. You need to give them that dopamine hit instantly. And we need to find a mechanism to do that with them so that they know that they're getting that instead of delaying it and then kicking the cost of living problem down the road.
Susan, you use great terminology there. And do you think the regulator sits in the way, though? Because the type of language would engage with that generation, free money, because essentially that's what it is. But would the regulator be happy with us using that terminology? Because it is, but it isn't. And all of the stuff that goes around there. I do think it needs engagement from all parties, advisors, the regulator and central government.
Agreed. We did a focus group recently because we were thinking of how do we gamify this? And the message was loud and clear. Stop telling us to stop having our avocado and toast and our oat milk lattes, you know, and make it, you know, don't be condescending. Call it free money and give us a dopamine hit quickly. But you're right, that's probably a bit too revolutionary, but we need to start to think about engaging with people where they are for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely not here to defend the regulator, and I agree with everything that was said there. But I do think that's where they're trying to get to with the advice, guidance, boundary review work. I think they know that there's a problem. They know that inaction can be as disastrous for people as taking decisions. And I think they're consciously trying to get out of the way of the kind of communications you're talking about there. There's no reason to my mind why certainly a matched employer contribution shouldn't be able to be called free money for someone, because, you know, it is essentially, I think, you know, tax relief slightly different. But yeah, I think the regulator, more so than, you know, 10, 15 years ago, wants to get to a place where communication is more the way that Susan's talking about it, a real genuinely engaging way of speaking to people.
Well, yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens. You know, maybe we'll fast forward in 6 months' time, and if we have a general election, we may come back and sit down and say we were all wrong. So.
Almost definitely.
Yeah, we'd love that. My daughter might be speaking to you by then.
Yeah. Maybe she'll thank you for her pension by that point. But thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you very much for joining us on this FT Advisor podcast.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.